This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
In this episode, Ross Beveridge, co-founder of our podcast, and guests discuss the topic of digital cities and democracy. Digitalization is transforming cities, urbanization, and urban life. But how is it changing urban politics? What issues of justice and democracy are at stake in the advance of digital technologies? What are the power implications of the unending rise of corporate digital platforms like Amazon? How are social media platforms reconfiguring the ways we live in cities and the ways we conduct politics? And what does the future hold? Ross discusses these questions with four scholars who have recently published important books in this field. Miria Georgiou, who is a professor of media and communications and head of the Department of Media and Communications at LSE. She's the author of the book Being Human in Digital Cities, published by Polity Press. Rob Kitchen, who is a professor in the Social Sciences Institute at Maynooth University. He's the author of Critical Data Studies, an A to Z guide to concepts and methods, published by Polity Press. Yu Shan Tseng, who is an anniversary research fellow in geography at the University of Southampton. She's the author of Liquid Democracy, a comparative study of digital urban democracy, published by Wiley and Sons. And lastly, Justus Uttermark, who is professor of urban geography and the academic director of the Amsterdam Institute for Social Science Research at the University of Amsterdam. He is, together with Petra Turnberg, the author of Seeing Like a Platform, an inquiry into the condition of digital modernity, published by Routledge. And now, let us dive into the episode.
Just to get our conversation started, everyone, I suppose when I was thinking about this this question of digital cities and politics and digital cities and democracy, I realized that, although I have a rough idea of what digitalization is and what it's doing, I haven't really considered it in my own research ever. And I kind of reflected on the stuff that I read, and often the stuff I read about urban politics and democracy doesn't always or hardly ever really engages with these questions. That's kind of one of the reasons to bring you guys together as a group. But to get started, I think it would be really helpful to just have a sort of definition of what the digital city is, a sort of simple kind of nuts and bolts type definition. It somehow brings together that relationship between the digital and the urban, and how it's been changing, how the city has been changing in relation to digitalization. And Rob, I was wondering if you could kick us off on that before we move on to some of the other guests.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, I kind of had a think about this question and kind of started with a kind of a potted history of the work that I've been doing on this. So I think the first time I kind of wrote about this was probably about 1998. I had a couple of books out around then, one on cyberspace, one on mapping cyberspace, which was kind of thinking around how the emerging internet was kind of changing the economy, politics, policy, you know, that those kinds of stuff. So kind of thinking around e-government, participatory democracy through, you know, early forms of communication through web platforms and so on. So it was an empirical work, probably first really started around that, around open data movements and the idea about open data kind of facilitating citizen participation in local politics, policy making, and so on. And did quite a lot of work on kind of sharing data across the border into Northern Ireland based around the emerging peace process in the early 2000s. I guess most of the work would have really started though with the code space work in the mid 2000s, where really starting to think around how digital technologies were shaping urban governance. And that kind of culminated in the code space book in 2011. And we kind of developed this kind of notion of automated management. So it's really around governance rather than democratic politics, although they're obviously interlinked. So automated management is kind of systems that are automated, autonomous, and automatic. So these are kind of human off the loop kinds of systems that where how I kind of say like movement around the city, for example, might be controlled by an intelligent transport system that just works in autonomous kinds of ways. And looking at things like data shadows, data footprints, changing nature of governmentality, particularly the idea of switching from discipline to control. That's really developed again further in the Data Revolution book. So looking at open data, citizen participation, citizen science, data valence and governance, particularly notions of anticipatory governance. So these are kind of systems that try to predict what's going to happen and act on the future before the future happens. So predicted policing, for example, would be one kind of system. And another kind of idea is around control creep. So systems designed to regulate one form of behavior being used to regulate others. So you've got technology creeping across into domains for which it wasn't initially rolled out. And then in the second edition of that book, we'll expand it a lot more to think around ideas of governmentality, again, data ethics, data justice, data sovereignty, notions of citizenship, impacts of data capitalism back into the public domain as well. So corporatization of city systems. So what does it mean when corporations start to run public services? And that was really examined in the Programmable City Project. It's ran from 2013 to 18, so it was really around smart city technologies. And myself and Paola Cordella kind of like revisited Sherry Arnstein's ladder of participation and mapped that onto smart city technologies, kind of looking at the extent to which citizens can have a say in what's happening with the smart city. So kind of looking at citizen resistance, bottom-up initiatives, repurposing of tech rather than abandoning it, looking at alternative political framing, such as technological sovereignty in Barcelona and kind of the shift to try and move to open source alternatives to the big proprietary systems. I have a couple of chapters in the Timescapes book on how digital technology is transforming temporalities of politics and policy, and also governance and governmentality. So things like altering time rules, what happened, you know, what's the effect of 24/7 news media cycles, you know, the effect of social media shifting political currents rapidly. So things like Arab Spring, Me Too, and so on, shifting how elections are fought. And we all know about Musk buying Twitter to effectively influence a political campaign, and issues around governance. So things like altering policy cycles, fast policy, fast activism, and so on. And then in the slow computing book is just looking at this was a book about how we take control ourselves personally, but also collectively try to push back against some of these things. So how do we kind of challenge and organize, you know, so whether that's slow movements or the right, you know, the right to disconnect and all of those kinds of things. So that's a very potted kind of history of different things, and hopefully it's tapped onto different kind of elements of this. But this has been as you probably picked up, this has been shifting over time, you know, shifting from the kind of internet onto platforms and different forms of technologies and different deepening of what the technologies are capable of doing. Yeah, this is kind of a gradual transformation as different technologies are kind of embedded in.
Thanks, Rob, that's very helpful. Also to have that sense of progression in your work and through the debates over time. So Maria, I was when I was reading your recent book, Being Human, Digital City, it really struck me how you set it up in a very kind of political way, in a very kind of normative, argumentative stance. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about that, that constellation of politics as it relates to the digital city that you engage with, and mention some of the key players. And and I was struck also how closely you relate developments to ongoing crises over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, and and how that links to the idea of post-neoliberalism. You mentioned a number of points in your book. So what if you just sort of describe that constellation of politics that you kind of set up in relation to your recent book?
Thank you. I think it's interesting hearing at Rob's introduction to how he conceives and how he applied the digital city, to see also how differently perhaps many of the people that work in that space and who engage with the concept of the digital cities, how we approach it in different ways. I should say in dialogue to Rob's introduction and also as an introduction to your to my answer to your question, that I think that my origins and the way that I approach the digital in relation to the city has to do with the fact that I am a communication scholar, and I'm a scholar that has been interested for a long time about what's happening in cities as both lived and political spaces. So in my first book that engaged with cities, The Media and the City, it was a book back in 2013, I tried to understand how process of mediation shaped the city as spaces of inclusion and exclusion. And as we see cities becoming more and more digitized, I built on this work to think about how digitization as a new form of communication rather than primarily or merely as an infrastructural process that has to do with the politics and the technocratic intentions of efficiency and order, how the process of digitization actually shapes the city as a democratic or non-democratic space, as a space where different actors has the possibility to be recognized, misrecognized, or expelled from the city. My approach in being human in digital cities, the book that you refer to, is to start with a provocation in discussing digital cities. And what I'm arguing is that perhaps we should not start from technology, but to start from the human, if we are to understand how cities are actually shaped digitally. And I'm doing that because for different reasons, and this goes, I guess, to the heart to your question. What are the claims that are made in cities through the mobilization of technologies? And the basic argument I'm trying to put forward is that this specific moment that we're going through, a moment that I identify as a moment of compounded crisis, crisis of capitalism, crisis of the neoliberal economic and political order, cities do not only become spaces where we see the expression of those crises in the same way as the nation, but we see the cities as a space where those crises are particularly faced, understood, and contested within the ecology of cities. So I'm looking at the ecology of very different cities across the world, so from places like London to Athens all the way to Havana, to see how the urban ecologies allow certain negotiations of the crisis through digitization. And the claim that I make is that we see digitization being mobilized to promise a better future, a future outside this crisis, where different actors from the very powerful actors of the city, corporations, digital corporations, policymakers, all the way to the inhabitants of the city and the protesters and the social movements, are mobilizing digital technologies very differently, but they're all mobilizing digital technologies to try to find ways to this better future outside those crises of liberal democracy and neoliberal economics. I'll stop here because I can go on forever giving other people the chance to talk and, of course, to answer any follow-up questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Maria. Well, Eustace, that might be a good time. I think you see some kind of links there between what Maria's work and also Rob's, of course. And your latest book, Seeing Like a Platform, but I mean also the other work you've also done on digital cities and the questions of the politics. So how do you approach that entity, the digital city, and what kind of arguments are you making about it in your recent work, thinking also in particular of this idea of digital modernity?
I should maybe start by saying how I became interested in the digital in the first place, and also when I became interested. So this was around 2010, 2011. And you may remember there was a time of major crisis. It was also a time of major protest. So I remember seeing the news headlines when WikiLeaks was having their releases like day after day. And at some point, there was this group called Anonymous that had sabotaged websites. So it had basically knocked out websites by Visa, MasterCard. And I was amazed. I was so surprised to see this because I had no idea about these technologies at the time. I didn't know exactly what was happening, but I was very much intrigued. And so that's also the moment that I became very interested in the literature on social media, on politics, on democratization, and so on. And I think at that moment in time, many people still felt that social media, digital platforms, were by and large emancipatory. So one key figure here is Manuel Castells, who argued that social media allowed activists to create horizontal networks, to bypass media. And so I became very interested in the relationship between digital platforms on the one hand and politics, protest on the other hand. And I started doing some research into this, so I became very interested also in computational methods. And I started doing what many other people were doing at the time, which is to say, oh, there's a protest. Now I take a hashtag and I look at all posts related to that hashtag. And then I sort of map out the protest space. So I became very interested in this. And I indeed concluded that social media were heavily implicated in protest. However, I also realized early on that I was sort of sampling on the dependent variable. Like if there was a protest, then I would look at a hashtag. And I became interested in trying out a more agnostic approach. So with John Boy, I started studying Instagram. I didn't know Instagram at all at the time. He introduced me to it. And the reason he introduced me to it was that we were able at that moment in time to download all geotagged messages posted in Amsterdam. So here we were able to track protests over time and through space. So you're absolutely fascinated by this idea. And then we started looking at the data. And we found that actually people didn't use Instagram at all for protesting. So people were showing pictures of beautiful sunrises. They showed pictures of trees. They were showing off their new sneakers. And so when I tell this to my students, they say, well, what do you expect? Instagram isn't for protest. But so maybe I was a bit naive, but I was naive in part because of what the literature had led me to expect. I expected people to use social media to protest. So I also expected that cities would become more contentious as a result of social media. And this isn't at all what we found. And so for me, that was a reason to start rethinking digital platforms and to think about how they were shaping the spaces of possibility within cities. And so I won't go into all the details, but I do want to give you the conclusion from the book I wrote with John Boy, which is on display, which is specifically on Instagram. And so we found that actually we don't find polarization at all. So this is what the literature led us to expect. We found actually that these Instagram networks were tightly integrated. Relatedly, we didn't find a lot of extremism. In fact, we found a lot of conformity. And also we didn't see like these horizontal networks that Castells was talking about. Instead, we saw extremely uneven degree distributions. So this was a very hierarchical, tightly integrated, conformist space, which isn't at all what we expected. And so this then led me to rethink the role of platforms, the role of politics. And so that also led me to think like, oh, I'm just at the very beginning of trying to understand the relationship between digital platforms and politics. I'm sorry I didn't answer your question about the book I did with Petter, but I had to say this first because this sort of set me up to dive deep into digital modernity.
Wonderful. Thank you. So there's no problem. We can come back to that idea, I think, in perhaps the next set of questions. So Yushan, you just wrote a really great book, Liquid Democracy, quite recently. So how did you approach this thing, the digital city? And one thing I was struck in your book was the way in which you really approached it as a sort of an epistemological question. You know, how can I know this politics of the digital city? So I wonder if you could position your work in relation to some of those ideas.
Thanks for the great prompt, Rob. I'm the most junior researcher in the room. So I just recently published a book entitled Liquid Democracy. It has nothing to do with the model of liquid democracy, which people delegate a vote to algorithm or, you know, other elites. But it is, yes, it's to use liquidity as a metaphor to rethink democratic politics in digital city. So to start with, yes, I'm building on my understanding of digital city upon, you know, great works from Rob and many geographers who have done a lot of work in digital city, and also STS scholars. So I think in general, the common sense is, yes, digital technology and platforms, they've changed the way in which cities are governed, and specifically they change the way in which like political decisions and actions and procedures are made. So they are no longer, so for example, they're no longer made by humans now. you don't know who is making decision. It's a combination of algorithm or human, or, you know, purely AI, which is possible. And also they no longer follow normative procedures embedded in liberal democracy. So therefore I would think of technology as intervening and infiltrating into whichever has been considered as normative politics. So what I want to highlight in my book is the everyday technology has reshaped how we conduct and going about everyday life practices. So a lot of digital politics is inseparable from the decision we make in everyday life. The fact that how we decide to post or like on Twitter or now X, or decide not to do something on X, all these choices that we made are political and has implication in democratic politics. This digital spaces has become very, very fluid, meaning that things are being shaped quite contingently, but also contextually. And that opens up possibility and challenges for democracy. I'm a geographer, so I think if you're taking a very theory-driven approach, you're only looking for certain type of urban politics from certain places and spaces. But if you look at democratic politics just from the very fluidity of what's happening, what things are being changing in everyday, digitally mediated everyday life, then you're going to find different kinds of democratic politics playing out there.
Just the last bit of the question made me think of, I think there's a line in your book where you say that when you're talking about how you're going to, or what you're going to research, you say something like you're going to look for democracy as it exists in the field. And that kind of like really struck me as quite daring in a way. I mean, there is that tradition of looking for democracy, not reading it off of theory, high theory, and rather looking at it through practices of everyday life in the city. That's something that's really innovative and powerful about your book. And I was just wondering when we're talking about democracy now, it seems already. So I was just thinking when Yushan was talking about that space of the everyday, I was thinking a little bit about your book, Maria, your more recent book, which you talk about, is it critical humanism as this kind of the space of the demos or something like, or demotic humanism as the space where, you know, where there's a possibility for publics to emerge, for collective interests to emerge, and for these kind of contests that we associate with democracy. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about how you relate your work to the sort of the bigger questions of democracy and what kind of, I suppose, hopes and fears you have in relation to the work that you've been doing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I mentioned earlier in my response that I'm exploring in this book across different cities and in relation and in my engagement with different actors, from the technocrats all the way to refugees and migrants and the racialized minorities of cities. I'm exploring how digital technologies might be mobilized differently for those different actors to promise or to attempt to find pathways out of the current moments of compounded crisis. Part of the argument is that what we see is that in cities, in response to those compounded crises, we see rise of claims to human dignity, freedom and autonomy, which are claims that different actors make differently. You asked me to speak about demotic humanism, and in a way, the way that I talked about demotic humanism is very much related to what Yushan just spoke about, the politics of everyday life and the spaces of possibility, but also of limits when we think about how can we think about, you know, the democratic possibility, democratic politics, which are actually connected to the politics of dignity, freedom, and autonomy, not for the few, but for the many. So I'm looking into cities and I'm looking at different sides of ordinariness in cities to try and find out the different ways through which different actors of the city try to find their way or envision ways to autonomy, dignity, and freedom. And I try to do that primarily by starting from the margins. So I'm very interested, and my work has been largely with populations in the margins, transnational and urban margins. So I'm more interested in how the urban humans who are experiencing constant and longstanding marginality, how they try to find their space to the public space, how they try to find voice and recognition. I come up with this concept of demotic humanism, which reflects this idea that there is a process that happens in everyday life where the demos, literally the people, are trying to set forward those ideals through everyday practices, the ideals of humanism. I looked at everyday practices such as sharing Wi-Fi among different neighbors, all of them having limited resources. So in Athens, for example, in more impoverished neighborhoods of the city, someone buys Wi-Fi and everybody shares the expense. So we see examples like that, where there's a demotic attempt to claim a space within that the digital space. I mentioned examples such as those in Havana, where again, access to the internet is very very scarce and very expensive. And where we see residents of Havana hacking the systems, the Wi-Fi systems of expensive hotels, so that they can claim their space into the transnational space of the internet, where they can speak, but also where they can have access to information that is otherwise restricted to them. I give other examples of how refugees try to hack the system that constantly monitors them by creating different social media profiles so that they find spaces of freedom within that very restrictive space where they exist in European cities. I see that space of humanism as that space of hope, again, as Yushan just spoke, the space of hope of democratic politics. But I also see that space of the demos as a demotic humanism as a space that always comes with limitations, precisely because that everyday politics of solidarity and everyday resistance is not directly contesting the order that very much reproduces monitoring of refugees, very much reproduces the exclusion of the habaneros from having full access to transnational internet. And this is where my proposal of critical humanism comes in, as more of a politics, a praxis, and a commitment to more transformational politics through digitization.
Thank you, Maria. This might be a good time to bring you in. I don't know if it totally connects to the digital modernity, but probably it does in some way. But how do you approach this question of the democratic implications of digitalization in the city and in the work that you've done? It struck me, at least in your most recent book on a platform, which is not only about cities, you talk a lot about power and the sort of power of knowledge. I was really struck at one part of the book where you talk about there's lots of new developments and there's a new epistemology in the digital modernity, but it's also reinforcing existing power relations. There isn't always as much change as we think there is, and some of the change is also quite problematic. So without trying to put words into your mouth, which I probably already have, could you just sort of open up a little bit the possibilities, I suppose, as well as the danger zones of for democracy in relation to digital cities?
Yeah, thank you, Ross. Yeah, in the book with Petter, Seeing Like a Platform, indeed, we talk about epistemologies of power, how are societies imagined. And so to make this very specific, very concrete, we can think of a classical confrontation in cities that between Robert Moses on the one hand and Jane Jacobs on the other. And so Robert Moses viewed the city as a sort of complicated system, like a clockwork, and he could reorganize it to make it more efficient. And then Jane Jacobs saw it more as a complex system with emergent qualities, with fine-grained webs of relationships. And it's very interesting to see that many people who are very enthusiastic about the possibilities of digital technologies now talk about Jane Jacobs and celebrate her as a complexity theorist. And I think it's fair to say that also planning theorists, complexity theorists, they all agree that Robert Moses got it all wrong and Jane Jacobs got it all right. However, I think this idea that the city is a complex system also comes with certain limitations. Like for one, it naturalizes what happens in the city. So if you see a city as a self-organizing system, then you also come to sort of accept the ground rules. For instance, segregation, gentrification, they come to be seen as natural processes that then policymakers should guide towards just ends. And so this is very interesting, because before we had Robert Moses, who was a very violent man, very brutal man. But we did know he is creating the city that he wants. And now when you listen to policymakers, when you listen to complexity scientists, they say that we need to sort of accept bottom-up principles of organization. And so this can also mean that you accept bottom-up principles of gentrification and segregation. So in the book, we talk a lot about how cities are seen and what is seen as natural and what is seen as acceptable. For me, this is something I'm struggling with now, which I find very interesting. So we don't have Robert Moses anymore. Instead, we have now a much less open, much less brutal, but also much more profound and also disturbing development. So we don't have the industrial modernity of Robert Moses, but we have the digital modernity being brought by companies like Google, like Meta, and they're not changing our cities completely. They're not imposing their views from above. Instead, they're trying to sort of harness complexity. So digital technology is woven into the urban fabric. And so this isn't as brutal, but the effects are rather profound. So one thing that I see over and over for different platforms, say for Google Maps or for TikTok, is that it makes the city more predictable. So Google Maps product vision is to give you an immersive sense of place while you're not there. And so this is very interesting because it means that places have to conform to the expectation of platform users. And I talked to many restaurant owners, for instance, who feel very much disciplined by the reviews they're constantly getting. And so they have to provide services. Another example is TikTok lines, which we have in the center of Amsterdam. So people come for a very specific cookie, and they come in very, very large numbers. And so we see here in cities that people are looking for this very, very specific thing. That's exactly what they want. And so what I'm thinking about now is how these digital technologies are changing also what makes cities interesting and democratic. Because I think one thing that makes cities democratic and interesting is that they're incomplete, that they're unpredictable, that there's serendipity. And these digital technologies, they're now making cities more predictable. And they're sort of programming space for very specific functions. And this isn't as brutal as Robert Moses once was, but it is a very profound impact that in the end, I think, also erodes the city as a democratic space.
Rob, do you want to come in on that, the effect of digital technologies on the political life of the city, the social life of the city, and I suppose what that means for the prospects of the city as a democratic space?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess most of my work really has been around the kind of smart city technologies that are not really community platforms. So they're your intelligent transport systems and your dynamic routing of bin garbage trucks and all this kind of stuff. And there where I think the interesting thing around democracy is really the tension between executive and reserve functions. So this is basically the tension between politicians and bureaucrats, or representative democracy versus technocratic intervention. So that's definitely kind of shifting. And then the other kind of area there is really kind of the neoliberalization of city administrations, where it's increasing marketization, privatization, outsourcing, public-private partnerships. So the corporatization of city services that used to be kind of decided through city councillors and representative forms of democracy becoming kind of more technocratically mediated and decided by bureaucrats and non-elected corporations. So for me, that's kind of a big kind of shift. And it's also shifting the governmentality within cider cities from kind of more disciplining forms of governance through to more kind of control forms. So kind of remediating, reshaping people's behavior rather than getting them to self-discipline. Which is a very different kind of space to, people bottom-up self-organizing through social media or through civic media projects and so on. Although they might well be doing those in relation to what's happening in the city to try and push back and resist against them. So I think Manor was pointed towards kind of DIY activism, data activism, community hackathons, all this kind of stuff, citizen science and so on, that tries to, which again is not necessarily a kind of a community kind of thing. It's more a kind of action doing, building, making kind of interventions. I guess the other kind of thing that I'm just started to get interested in around the kind of possibility of democratic politics is really around this kind of notion of authoritarianism in the digital age. So I've just started to edit a special issue on this, which kind of exceeded my expectations on the call for papers. So we had 178 abstracts for this special issue. So this is definitely a moment. And I think we've commissioned 52, so we've got 52 kind of commentaries. So we're limiting people to kind of 2,000 words, but it's covering nearly 30 countries. And kind of what's interesting there is in the relationship to which the digital is being used in governance and in policing, and in the ways in which people are being marked out and controlled and disciplined in very explicit kind of ways, the ways in which the digital is altering media narratives, altering political discourse, shifting rhetoric, shifting the way in which populations think. And the digital itself is becoming highly regulated and also becoming ever more corporatized. You only have to kind of think of the highly regulated if you think of countries like China or in the Middle East or wherever it might be. And then the tech industry itself is becoming politically active. You know, so the heads of these corporations in the US who very clearly line themselves up behind the political regime there and are using their technologies and, you know, the kind of actions of Doge and so on, which have very clearly as corporate actors in behind it. You know, and they're actively financing and supporting particular political positions. So that seems to me like a very kind of direct line where, you know, democratic politics is definitely being kind of reshaped by this kind of, I would characterize it as a shift to the right and the kind of drift into kind of aspects of authoritarian regimes. And we'll have to wait to see the extent to which some of them drift that far over or not, or the extent to which there'll be pushbacks. But even in cases like in the US at the weekend, there were massive protests. If you were to look at the New York Times, you would never know that they'd happened. You know, I think the protests in the US were like the 12th or the 13th story on their website, even though there's a, you know, over 10 million people on the streets. It's a non-event. It never happened. The media never covered it. So that's kind of, so I think that's kind of interesting in the way in which, you know, digital technologies are maybe eroding and undermining kind of principles and practices around expected forms of democracies and how that might be changing over time.
Thanks for that, Rob. I think it might be a good point to come back to you, Yushen, in your book. And because if I read your book, your argument correctly, I mean, the argument is more asked about the contingency of digital technologies. And you talk about is digital democracy platforms is a particular kind of constellation there, and how that relates to then your understanding of the possibilities of democracy, which you call liquid democracy. I wonder if you want to just, you've already mentioned it a little bit, I wonder if you want to say a little bit more about what kind of arguments about the possibilities of democracy come out of your book and that study that you did, I assume, for your PhD.
Thanks. So I think back to sort of understanding democratic politics as an epistemological problem is, in my book, I try to look at how democracy can be without buying immediately into the democratic theories and how democracy is supposed to be in a liberal democracy, because I realize all the Taipei, Helsinki and Madrid, these are the three cities I've done in-depth ethnography fieldwork in the past almost 10 years time. And so these cities are in the peripheral, or not even, they have interesting trajectories of democratization which undergone certain forms of authoritarianism. But the transition is somewhat peaceful, non-violent, to democracy. So that says something about the character of these three cities, how these cities become urban place, and then where activists, even from civil hackers to citizens or people who work in the government, they embrace technology in different ways that perhaps might not be available in more sort of usual suspects in smart cities, you know, New York, Los Angeles, Hong Kong. They, you know, so these cities, they do digital politics differently. And therefore that leads to a different kind of argument, different kind of engagement with democratic politics. So therefore, the fact I ask for a more to understand the terrain in which democratic politics play out in digital city is supposed to be a fluid one. That means it's not to deny the possibility that technology might really and very likely amplify the crisis of legitimacy, all these problems and challenges we are facing now in an age of, you know, platformization. I'm not denying that, but to understand how to open up the space for possibility is to engage and to directly work with the negatives or problems emerging in specific cities, right? Because you can't, as Justus said, you know, polarization might not even happen in Instagram in Amsterdam. So how can we assume polarization is happening everywhere? So I think I'm trying to kind of have a more situated but also contingent account, but also fluid account of what democratic politics is happening in these three cities, and hoping when we are understanding technology, we don't put them into this binary and almost put oppositional position, which is it's either against or anti-democracy. So in this fluid terrain, negative and positive might happen all together, and to reorient some of the challenges and problems towards a better city, meaning making a difference to those who suffer and marginalize in their everyday life, then we must engage the negative and not to kind of preclude, foreclose this possibility when we just impose all these theories and telling people what to do. And when I realized all these elderly, for example, when I was in Helsinki, this remote community, and the elderly, they wanted something from this participatory budgeting platform. So they went on learning how to use QR code. They know much more about how to do democracy than me. And then they ended up having these very decayed and in ruined the cultural heritage, getting renovated, get the money from the government, or in Taiwan, there's even the scale is even happening at the national where the Uber and taxi driver would be able to negotiate for a better and transparent payment to relocalize Uber company in conformity of what's happening locally at the local regulation. So I think a lot of things, what I'm trying to say is more of a reflection really for me when I was trying to understand what's going on in the field, is if I am biased towards certain theories and certain locations in thinking democracy, then there are other things will never come about. And therefore the book is trying to think democracy otherwise and more fluidly, and to engage with the alternative. Of course, but there's always a limitation. The limitation always comes in when politics being grounded in the urban world and delimited by the regulation, by the infrastructures, things are happening in cities.
So just a quick follow-up question to this, and so sort of a concluding session then. So we think about what the future holds, you know, given the pace of change with AI and other technologies. Yushan, where do you think we'll be in 5 to 10, 20 years? Can liquid democracy save the city?
I think in my book, I'm really modest about liquid democracy. I never make a universal claim that if we understand democracy from this fluid to contingent situation, then technology is going to save or transform urban governance per se. But I think it's changing how we think, right? Then perhaps they might change how we act as a scholar and maybe, you know, understand the world slightly, seeing the world slightly differently. So in answering your question, yes, AI, I have a few grant applications going on with AI and democracy. I'm not sure I'll get a grant, so I'm not sure I would be comfortable to tell you the answer, but because I think I'm really influenced by sort of Donna Holloway. So I think also for my positionality, I think AI and technology, this source is unlikely and uncontrollable yet powerful actors. So that can potentially become an ally for democracy. If you don't use AI for the sake of democracy, to reorient it towards democratic possibility, then other people are going to use it for other purposes. So it depends on how we use AI. And it's also important not to say AI is inherently democratic or anti-democratic, right? And this is what is more important is see how AI is acting, what AI is doing in everyday life. So for example, Google DeepMind, they have this new thing called Habermas machine. They think they can automate deliberation and to find common ground across differences. And I think this requires evidence-based investigation to see what is actually happening in a real world. And there's also some of SME companies in the UK, such as Suffragel, they try to re-innovate sort of democratic platform, again, use large LLM, large language models to find the sort of commonalities across different opinion groups in a presumably polarized discussion. So I think it's really hard because I think to really embody this really strong democracy for long-lasting effect, there's a need for strong institutionalization, a change in political culture. And that's really beyond like, let's install an AI and everything will be solved. It is to open up a space of possibility, and that requires a lot of work from human, different kind of human actor to really reorient technology towards a better future that really make a difference for the marginalized in the everyday life.
Thank you, Shada. Well, I don't know if you want to come in. When you look into your magic ball, what do you see in 5-10 years? What the prospects of for the city with the pace of change and the type of politics we have at the moment? And
yeah, I'm hesitant about these kind of questions because like trying to forecast the future is kind of doomed to failure. It's stuff always happens that you're not quite expecting, or you know, things veer off and whatever. I think the first thing to say is that digital isn't going to go away. You know, it's very firmly entrenched, and we're on a path of things becoming ever more digitally mediated. So the key questions really are normative. I think, you know, it's not do we want a smart city. It's what kind of smart city do we want, and what kind of politics and what kinds of forms of governance, and you know, do we want to ensure that the democratic city is possible, you know, and crises come along, so it'll always be inflected by other kinds of crises, whether that's going to be climate, environmental, or social, political, or economic, financial, or war and terror, or you know, that's always going to shape the future, and we're never quite sure. You know, you just have to think about how COVID-19 led to quite significant shifts in things like work patterns, normalized certain forms of governance in terms of like lockdown and monitoring, fueled all kinds of conspiracy theories, has pushed politics in certain directions in relation to health and other kinds of things. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's really to keep alive the normative and to kind of keep continually having these conversations about what kinds of cities and societies that we want to live in, being able to kind of resist and push back on that open for people to do. Otherwise, it potentially looks quite, you know, depending on where you are, things seem to be on a certain kind of path, and it's about trying to knock that kind of path out so it doesn't become some kind of path dependency. If there's one thing I think that we really needed to do, it would be to dismantle billionaire news media, social media platforms, and recast back to public service broadcasting. Because I think it's going to be pretty difficult to shift things back to more progressive lines while that's in place. It's going to be a pretty uphill battle.
Think of sort of the near future, 5 years, maybe 20 years. I mean, are you so how optimistic, how pessimistic, glass half full, glass half empty? What kind of things need to change, as Rob's suggesting? How do you think about the future in the current times?
I also got nervous when you asked the question to predict the future. You know, it's very risky to predict the future. But then I thought, I mean, there are two things to say. First of all, it's like the future is always now. And the future is always now, especially when it comes to digitization, because ironically, everything that changes now and in many ways, that project of smartness is very much always promising something for the future. So many of the decisions that are being made, you know, around digital transformation of cities is about the promise of the future to come. So there's certain kind of future that we're being promised in 5, 10, 20, 100 years through the logic of smartness, especially in smart transformation, which is very much a pessimistic future, I think, from where we stand as a group. So it's a future of prediction, modeling, and order, where cities will be, technologies will do wonders so that everything in the cities can be ordered, controlled, and all the risks that come with the life of the city can be at least controlled, if not eliminated. This, I think, it's a very dangerous future, especially because we see investment in logics and technologies where we see the same kind of models and the same kind of predictive modeling being applied to everything from sanitation to policing to democratic process and access to citizenship. And this is the future we have to be afraid of. I want to speak to the two alternative futures. One is the normative. I will just acknowledge what Rob said, that it's very important to keep normative ideals of the kind of future that we want. And I think those values and this commitment to advance transformative politics, and transformative politics come with challenging the over-concentration of power, for example, in big tech, but also the acknowledgement of responsibility, or more precisely, the lack of democratic responsibility for those that are actually causing all the crises within cities and across. And I want to finish also with that other dimension, the demotic dimension of the alternative future, that to me, and I hope that's not just my naivety, is that the future is not only digital, but it's also urban. And cities are not facing the challenges of attempt for full control, autocracy and authoritarianism for the first time. I mean, Eustace mentioned, of course, the example of Moses, the archetypical symbol of urban control. And cities have always proposed different ways of living and managing and resisting, sometimes more successfully, sometimes perhaps less successfully, all these constant in history attempts to fully control and order cities. So I have to hold on that hope, because our future is urban, it's not just digital.
Yeah, I like that. And keep the optimism, keep the faith. Eustace, what are your thoughts on what the future holds for the city and digitalization?
I love the responses so far, because they're also way more optimistic than I'm going to be. And I fully agree with Rob that we should sort of resist predicting the future. But I like the exercise, because I think by predicting the future, we sort of say, okay, these are the trends that are dominant. These are the forces that are dominant. And then we can see 5, 10 years from now whether we were right, or maybe there were things that we were overlooking. So I hope I'm going to be wrong, because I think, first of all, to respond to Miria directly, yes, the future is not just going to be digital, it's also going to be urban. But I do think that the very idea of urbanity is being hollowed out by digitalization. So as I mentioned earlier, urbanity depends on serendipity, on encountering strangers, on surprise. And these qualities of cities are being undermined by digital technologies. And I think this erodes the very foundation of an urban democratic politics. So I'm not optimistic at all in this respect. Another thing that I think we're seeing already, and we will see more, is that power is becoming increasingly opaque. So in the book with Petter, we also discuss redlining. And so redlining in the United States was a horrible practice, but it was clear who was doing it. The maps were there on the wall. We know who developed the indicators. We knew the effects. If we now look at AI, if we now look at algorithms, we don't really know how they decide on who gets a mortgage or not. And so I expect that it will be increasingly difficult to hold power accountable, that transparency will be greatly reduced. So I'm not optimistic on that count either. And I'd love to be wrong. Huh? And so another thing that I would expect, it's something that we can't really see at the moment yet, but I think it's incipient, is a social differentiation between, on the one hand, people who still are able to rely on face-to-face contacts and people who need to rely on AI. And so you see this, for instance, already somewhat with people who are lonely and who are turning to AI to look for friends, to look for companionship, to look for advice, whereas other people still rely on humans. And so Randall Collins sort of predicts a world where people who are powerful increasingly rely on face-to-face contacts, whereas people who are subordinate, who are dependent, rely on AI. And we can see this already, like with technology companies making all sorts of plans to replace teachers with AI. They won't do this at Harvard, but they will do it further down the educational hierarchy. So I'm not optimistic about it either. And a last thing that I think is going to be a major trend is a different type of modeling of cities. So in the past, cities were modeled through blueprints. So that was one model of a city. Sometimes also people build models like Schelling's segregation model, very simplified model. And so these models were potentially quite violent in the sense that they imposed order on the city, but they were obviously wrong. So they were very simplistic. And I think we're seeing increasingly sophisticated models of cities. So it's already possible to ask AI agents to fill in surveys. It is possible to ask them to participate in experiments. And so this is quite important, I think, because what we will see in the future is that AI agents will increasingly do a lot of work that was before done by humans. It is potentially detrimental to cities, in part because these technologies are being used for manipulation and especially the sale of advertisements. So I am going to end on a positive note. But so I really agree that you should study contingencies, that you should do this situationally. But I also think that we shouldn't underestimate the immense power, the immense investments that are behind the current AI trend. And these investments are made with very specific ideas in mind, with the idea that there will be revenue in the future, with the idea that there will be control in the future. And so very powerful people staked their money on this type of predictable future. And I think that doesn't bode very well for democracy. So the positive note is that indeed predictions are very often wrong. And in that sense, I really hope also that cities will be a place where these AI technologies will fail to achieve their predictive power, and that cities will in a way speak back to these corporations and will sort of be a counterforce to the increasing control of social life and democracies.
Wonderful. Thank you, Eustace. Does anyone want to respond to Eustace's generally more pessimistic, although he finished on an optimistic note? This idea of the immense power that is congregating there and what that means for trying to resist it or trying to change it.
Yeah, so I think like So I think there are kind of moves in Europe, and there's definitely moves in the Netherlands for trying to disinvest from some of the kind of tech and corporations that you're talking about. And it might well be that Europe takes a different path to what's happened in China or what's happening in the US and other parts of the world. So I think that'll be interesting to see what happens with legislators and politicians, regulators, in relation to how they, you know, interact in the space. I mean, I saw this morning on the news, for example, that one of the northern German federal states has said that the whole of the public sector will be off of Microsoft and onto open source alternatives within 3 months, and that all the schools and teachers will follow within 6 to 9 months afterwards. You know, so that's a, you know, and I know, for example, in some of the Dutch universities, you're looking to get off of the Microsofts and Googles and the Amazon cloud and onto, I think it's it's a German cloud provider, isn't it? That's a lot of the Dutch universities seem to be thinking and moving towards. So, I mean, that'll be interesting to see whether in some parts of the world there is a kind of a regulatory shift to move away from reliance on some of these very large proprietary companies. Again, in the Netherlands, I think you've set up your own national AI training data center, for example, so that you're not reliant on OpenAI and some of the American corporations, and that you're in control of your own models and so on. So that'll be interesting to see whether national governments or others see kind of national security threats, or see kind of threats to their autonomy, I guess, over their digital sphere. Yeah, so I think that'll be interesting to see whether that kind of happens, and what kind of response the EU or EU nations make, particularly in relation to AI.
Anyone else like to jump in there?
I can totally see where Justus, the pessimism comes from. I want to return, though, to not just the urban, but also the urban humans. And just to mention, because Rob just mentioned, you know, processes that happen, perhaps optimistic processes that happen on a more institutional level. But I want to return also to the urban humans and what is happening on the urban street that does already. Again, the future is always now. And I think we see also a different future, or at least a different hope for the future right now on the streets of many, many cities. And this goes, spreads from the US to Europe, to Indian cities, and so on. We might not see that a lot. And I think there's something deliberate that is happening there. The fact that the anti-Trump protests are not in the New York Times, or the pro-Palestinian protests are nowhere to be seen in the British media, reflects that current order, the current media and digital order. But the fact that they are still happening, and they are happening with so much power, and against that, these politics of invisibility, I think, point also to the fact that I think the serendipity, the juxtapositions of difference, that openness of the city are still there, even though absolutely they are taking a hit from so many different directions.
Thank you, Yushan. Do you have anything to add there?
Okay, I'll say something really quickly. I agree with what all of us said, because I think Nirvana for democracy is really not built by pure fantasy. It's really built by stories and actions that foster unlikely alliances and affinities for the sake of collective struggles, in which cities again and again shows us so many times throughout history and across different locations. And so when city undergoes digitalization or being controlled, predicted by AI, I think as scholar, I mean, it's better to let the city speak, let the urban world speak for itself, and the people who live and whether they are suffering or being marginalized in the city speak for themselves in terms of how they are going to do with the AI, for the better or for the worse. And as a researcher, you can only do a better work to understand what's going on.
I just had one final thought there. I mean, I know we're getting towards the end of our time. I was just reflecting on the comments now and some of the differences between what each of you have been saying and this real ambivalence about the idea that resisting the politics of AI or platform capitalism, or engaging in sort of democratic politics in the digital city, might have very little to do with actually coming together. I mean, you see that differently. I know you were very clear about that, but this idea of people coming together on the street or building organizations might not have the kind of impact, or we might not have, we shouldn't necessarily have the kind of belief in that form of politics, given the way that power works and all these power circuits work in very different ways. And you can control narratives, and you can control the sense of how truth is made in places, even if, you know, 500,000 people go on the street and protest against Trump. I mean, I think that's, I'm generally quite optimistic, but that makes me feel quite pessimistic. I don't know if anyone has any final thoughts, wants to jump in on that last thought of mine.
I think Myra was right near the beginning that you have to kind of cling on to hope, you know, that there will always be moments where, you know, you reach a point where things shift, and there's lots of examples in the past of authoritarian regimes toppling under people power, people rising up and reclaiming back. And you just have to hope that this kind of seesaw or swing back and forward kind of continues. I mean, there's lots of examples, you know, like of, you know, that we can kind of point out to even in the digital sphere. So I don't know, even if it's just, you know, Sidewalk Labs pulling out of Toronto, having invested a lot of money and try to create a smart city, and basically the citizens kind of saying, look, we're having none of this, you know. So it can happen, even if it's outside major news discourse, although I think, you know, the way in which the media is controlled is definitely a serious problem.
Maybe also sort of a final thought, at least on my part, like my experience is very much that the conclusion you reach is very much determined by the perspective you take. And so in the book I did with John Boy on Instagram and the city, we're not exactly optimistic, but we could see many different types of layers, and we rejected some of the more pessimistic conclusions. For instance, the idea that people would become self-obsessed or that people would become addicted to social media. This is not at all what we found. Instead, we found people engaging with social media in rather creative, reflexive ways. And so if you have a very situational analysis, you can see this sort of complexity, and you become alive to sort of different potentialities in everyday life. And I think that's also what Yushan and Mira especially are doing. And I think if you have sort of, if you look at the more policy level, European policy or Dutch national policy, you may also have some optimism. Then again, if you look at, as Petter and I have done in our most recent book, at platform companies and the sort of ideas that they have and the sort of resources that they have at their disposal, then I think you would come to very negative predictions about what urban life and digital life will look like in the future. So maybe for next project, I should switch perspectives back to cities so that I become a little bit more optimistic.
The only thing I would say back to that just is that people can stop using platforms, and there's lots of platforms that have just died. You know, like, you know, who remembers Friendster, who remembers MySpace? I mean, there's tons of them have died. I mean, Twitter is dying at the minute, you know, except for a, you know, a very particular kind of population, but, you know, lots of other people have left it. So platforms can die because people just stop using them. Like, if people stop using Airbnb tomorrow, it would die. you know, if nobody made bookings through it, it would just curtail. Now it'd be replaced with something else and whatever, right? But that something else could be based on a very different kind of platform ideal. So there's nothing intrinsic about a platform kind of being there forever. They can wither and they can be replaced.
Not a particular platform, no, but the platform economy as it is presently organized is like it does have some staying power, I think. And if you look at companies, their business models may not be successful in individual instances, but if you take companies like Meta or Google, like essentially they're advertising companies that try to carve out a big market space for themselves. And yes, they may fail and lose out the competition to others, but then it is only because those others are more successful at capturing our attention or selling us advertisements. So this overall logic, I think, is very difficult to move away from, at least for the foreseeable future.
I guess that's why we need transformative politics and a commitment to that.
I agree.
I think that's a fantastic way to end on a semi-optimistic note. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Ross.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Ross.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.